From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Barack Obama begins his second term. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
America's first black president was sworn in for a second term today on the national holiday dedicated to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Obama echoed King's call for unity at the same time acknowledging skepticism of central authority. He renewed commitments to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, promised response to climate change, and emphasized the equality of gay Americans. Did he make promises he can't fulfill? Did he reach out to Republicans or challenge them to more political conflict? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the First Lady and the Obama family. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Barack Hussein Obama was sworn in today for his second term with an inaugural speech that looked to the future.
A decade of war is now ending. An economic recovery has begun. America's possibilities are limitless, for we possess all the qualities that this world without boundaries demands. Youth and drive, diversity and openness, an endless capacity for risk, and a gift for reinvention.
Glenn Thrush is White House reporter for Politico. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi.
How did this compare to 4 years ago when the president made his inaugural speech, particularly in terms of the crowd? If you looked at it on television, there was a sea of waving American flags.
Well, I think one of the interesting dynamics here, Warren, is that the speech itself kind of reflected the crowd. It was a smaller crowd than in 2008. Those of us who were there in 2008 couldn't believe what we were witnessing. It was really, must have been like what Woodstock was like. But this was a smaller, more committed, more progressive crowd. And the speech that he gave, you know, while it had a lot of those Obama soaring rhetorical touches, was really very much an affirmation of that crowd's beliefs, a core progressive principles, and a challenge to the Republicans on everything from the wars to entitlement reform.
Challenge to the Republicans, it was very explicit. Here's the way one part of that sounded.
For now, decisions are upon us, and we cannot afford delay. We cannot mistake absolutism for principle, or substitute spectacle for politics, or treat name-calling as reasoned debate. We must act. We must act knowing that our work will be imperfect.
Back to Glenn Thrush with Politico. How do you think Republicans are going to respond to that?
Well, one of the interesting visuals, Warren, that I noticed was as Obama was making that, the camera had this image of Obama's teleprompter and Obama speaking, and hovering just above the teleprompter was the face of Louie Gohmert, the Texas Republican who's been one of his most caustic critics in the Congress, a guy who, for instance, called for the arming of teachers. If Gohmert's expression, which looked very dyspeptic, is any indication, I don't think Republicans on the Hill are going to respond too positively to it, but I have to say, I don't think Obama cares.
Why do you say that?
Because this is a different strategy that he has. If you look at his 2004 inaugural address and his first State of the Union, he was really talking about engaging in a more constructive bipartisanship, about sort of going across the lines in a direct way and negotiating. For various reasons, having to do with Republican recalcitrance and also Obama's own natural diffidence, he is not a great one-on-one negotiator, has not really reached out to people. That simply hasn't worked. The formula he has hit upon now, which is one that's very familiar to students of FDR and Truman, is to deploy public opinion. It's the one thing Obama has now, 52-55% personal approval rating, and use that as a cudgel to force Republicans into doing what he wants. So far, on smaller battles, it has worked since the election.
In what way?
Well, he got a fiscal cliff deal, which, while not optimal, was far more on his terms than he might have anticipated going into it. And we saw a couple of days ago, on the looming debt ceiling debate, Republicans recognizing that they would lose enormous political capital by going through one of those disasters again, giving a three-month extension. So I don't know how these huge fights over the sequester, you know, these $1 trillion in automatic spending cuts that are due to go in, or gun rights or immigration reform are going to transpire. But there is a sense in the White House that the way to go about this at this point is to hit them hard and then send Joe Biden in afterwards to negotiate the details.
The 2008 speech was regarded by a lot of people as kind of a letdown after the very exciting campaign and all of the emotion that it generated. He was kind of scolding, and he said it's time to put aside childish things. Was this fundamentally a better speech?
Yeah, this wasn't, you know, this, well, yes, absolutely, this was fundamentally a better speech. I think that this speech was precisely as good as Obama's performance at the debate in Denver was bad. You know, this is the guy, this was the one they were all waiting for, to paraphrase what Obama had said. I had a conversation with one of his speechwriters recently, and they viewed this speech as a bookend to his, not to his 2008 inaugural, but to his 2004 sort of maiden speech at the Democratic National Convention in Boston, the one that really put him on the map. That was a speech where he spoke about equality, about equity, the longer sweep of American history. But this one, 2013, was a much more belligerent, confrontational, really classical articulation of liberal philosophy, very much in keeping with the inaugural speeches of JFK and LBJ four or five decades ago.
So we just have a couple of seconds left, but does this presage then, do you think, a lot more conflict with Capitol Hill?
But you never know. How will this divided Republican conference in the House really deal with this? I mean, Obama and his folks are calculating that this will presage less conflict by being sort of tougher. You know, you sort of deal with, you know, it's the differing philosophy of sort of running a classroom, Montessori versus kind of the English system. The Obama folks think that being tough will get them to come to heel. House Republicans obviously have a very different idea.
Glenn Thrush, again, senior White House reporter for Politico. Thanks very much. We'll come back and talk further about the second inauguration of America's first black president on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the second inaugural speech of Barack Obama, his last, of course, as president of the United States. One of the themes that he hit was equality, and he extended the idea of equality beyond what other presidents have included. Here's a bit of it.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall.
Yohuru Williams is chair of the History Department and director of Black Studies at Fairfield University in Connecticut. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Seneca Falls, women's rights. Selma, civil rights, particularly for black Americans. And Stonewall, a gay rights moment. What significance do you attribute to this?
This is pretty remarkable on Obama's part, and we've seen this increasingly over the course of his presidency. His willingness to stake his reputation on supporting the rights of lesbian, gay, and transgendered Americans. And this was remarkable in the sense that he, this time, explicitly made the connection to Stonewall and placed it in this panoply of these transformational moments. Seneca Falls, Selma, of course, and then the 1969 Stonewall riots that began in New York.
What kind of emotion do you think this will generate on behalf of both his supporters and his opponents?
I think it will, in some sense, invigorate his base, particularly those who are looking for a statement from the president that in this second term clearly stakes what he feels are the key issues. And again, he's privileging and making a principal part of his second term dealing with this issue of equality for gay Americans. I think his opponents will seize upon this again as an opportunity to critique what they'll call mistaken priorities. But again, for the president, this is something he's been very clear on. I like the fact that, again, he chose to be sworn in using Martin Luther King's Bible, and in some sense saying that he sees this as the arc of a long journey, a long process to make the words of the Declaration of Independence and the preamble to the Constitution real to all Americans.
Did he not also use Abraham Lincoln's Bible?
He did. And again, very important, because he's placing those two moments, those two important watershed moments, where we see a deepening of American democracy in very tangible ways. The amendments come out of the Civil War. Certainly, you've got two major acts of Congress that come out of the Civil Rights Movement. And some have argued that maybe in the second term we may see some movement toward some type of legislation that deals with the issue of gay rights, and that may be necessary.
Yahuru Williams, again, a professor of Black Studies at Fairfield University, director of the Black Studies department there. Taylor Branch is a Pulitzer-winning author and historian. His latest book is The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Taylor Branch, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Where would you put Stonewall in the list of historic moments in the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, I would put it as somewhat submerged till now, but fully in the tradition. It's 1969. It's a year after Martin Luther King was killed. The word gay was not even in general use then, and homosexual behavior was still criminalized, and most gays were in the closet. So it shows how, in historical perspective, equal rights has advanced empirically far beyond the level that is appreciated in our current debate. There's a great disjoint in our current debate between our attitudes about the progress we're making and the progress that we actually have made.
You are an authority on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. How do you think he would have regarded this moment?
Well, it's always hazardous to speak for someone who's been gone for longer than he was alive. But I think, and it's safe to say, that he would say, as he's always said, we've come an awful long way, but we've got a long way to go, because that was his refrain throughout his career. Having said that, though, some of the things that have happened in the past 40 years really are astonishing in the light of his last lifetime. We have to remember that it was only 50 years ago, exactly this month, in January 1963, that two things occurred. Dr. King resolved to go to Birmingham and challenge segregation there in what became the tipping point of American politics for the whole decade. And that same month, George Wallace took office in Alabama in a famous speech pledging segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And all of the southern states were segregated right into their state constitutions in a rigid caste system, no one calling for its overthrow in that region. And Wallace failed, but in his failure and the astonishing progress that we've made since then in 50 years to get rid of segregation by race, by gender, and as you mentioned, by sexual orientation, George Wallace was a very inventive politician who, in failure, created a lot of the language that's chillingly contemporary about resentment and fear of those changes, and saying that they were pointy-headed bureaucrats telling us how to conduct our business and where to go to school, in league with a biased liberal media with a racial agenda to concentrate all central power in Washington, in the central government. Those are all phrases invented by George Wallace. They are kind of a dead end in current politics after 50 years, but they've had an astonishing long run to make us misremember how much progress we've made in the last 50 years.
Do you think that President Obama's emphasis on gay rights today in this speech will detract in any way from what I know you think is key to understanding American democracy, which is the role of race?
I don't think that it will detract. In some senses, I think it will substitute. The fact that Barack Obama has mentioned race less than any president in public than any, less than any president since Kennedy, shows how difficult an issue it still is. I mean, it's vitally important for race relations to have the first black president. Americans at all levels are getting comfortable with things that they still don't speak of very much. But whenever Barack Obama has mentioned race, it's caused all kinds of storms and troubles. I think that by mentioning gay rights explicitly itself and by emphasizing equality in a broad context that includes race, he actually has a chance to go forward and try to put our politics and our sense of possibility and what we can accomplish together back in some sort of balance with what we've actually done. Our record in the last 50 years in the sweep of history should be uplifting about tackling the toughest problems. And yet we've been trapped in this George Wallace myth that government is bad, and it really has had a paralyzing effect on our politics.
Taylor Branch again, a Pulitzer winner, author, and historian. A new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Here's just a bit more of what the president had to say today about gay rights.
Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well.
Yehuru Williams, let me come back to you with the director of Black Studies at the Fairfield University in Connecticut. Taylor Branch seems to think that this will help the president sort of advance the argument beyond the issue of race in a way, key as it is. Do you think that Black Americans who have expressed their disappointment that he has mentioned race so seldom will let him off the hook in this regard? Will they be supportive of what he has said about gay rights?
I think generally, yes. President Obama remains very popular among African Americans. And although there is a critique about his inability to really deal with the issue of race and to sometimes take for granted the support of the African American community, broadly speaking, on matters of race, this was a situation where the president really emphasized values, and values which, if we're talking about equality broadly construed, many African Americans buy into. It's important to note, and I know Taylor Branch knows all about this, that you have people within the civil rights movement, Bayard Rustin in particular, who were gay, who found themselves in a position where they had to deny their sexuality even as they fought for equality, absolute equality before the law for people of color. And so this is the logical progression of this movement for civil rights. And while some may disagree with how you define that, the ultimate, in the broad sense, they'll agree with the values that stand behind it. That as we progress as a society, these evolving standards of decency must include broadening our idea of what equality means and ensuring absolute equality before the law for all Americans.
Glenn Thrush is still with us, senior White House reporter for Politico. You suggested at the outset that there might be some sort of legislation involving this. What do you think it would be, and what are the prospects of getting it through the Congress?
Well, I think in terms of the just to sort of digress to what the other folks have been saying, I mean, it is an amazing evolution when you consider that Bobby Kennedy authorized wiretaps on Bayard Rustin, and J. Edgar Hoover tried to embarrass King because of the sexual orientation of his top lieutenant. Things have really changed. I think I think in that, as in all areas of latitude for the president, there is very little room to maneuver at the moment, and he's really front-loaded his agenda with a lot of stuff. I'd like to point to one thing he didn't mention at all during his speech, and that was gun control, which has obviously been the subject of most of his action in the last week or so. We've been told that the president will address the gun issue during his State of the Union, but I think it was notably absent in the speech today, and I've spoken with some gun rights advocates today who were sort of puzzled about its absence.
Taylor Branch, what would you say to that? How would that fit into the kind of strategy that you see the president beginning to follow?
Well, I think gun rights are incredibly important, but also very specific. And it seems to me that the strategy in this speech is to talk about values broadly, but very explicitly, and challenge people on the values about equal rights and equality, And it should translate very well into gun control, because part of the imbalance that I'm talking about in our memory of history and in our politics is that you've got an awful lot of people who are kind of curdled against the progress that we've made in the last 50 years and have convinced themselves fearfully and resentfully that their liberty, the chief guard of their liberty, is the bushmaster in their closet and not the rights and that we knit together across the differences that divide us. And that's really what makes America strong and what makes America free. So guns can be driven, that issue can be addressed in the broader context of equal rights, and that our surest protection is building up the liberties that we've been that the American experiment has been about from George Washington through Abraham Lincoln and up through Martin Luther King now to today. So I think that the broad strategy is what an inaugural address is for, and I stress what the Politico reporter and the professor from Fairfield both said, which is that to stress rights strongly and openly almost dares the other side to come out with explicitly their unspoken agenda, which is one of fear and resentment. And gun rights is merely an application of that. It's real and everything, but the president will shift the whole ground by trying, not worrying wholly about the people in Washington, but by shifting the common culture and of the people who decide who to send to Washington.
Back to Yohora Williams, the professor at Fairfield University. Is there a risk in this, in not reaching out more to the Republicans who do control the House, although, of course, they are at the moment famously divided?
I'm not sure, in the sense that Obama tried the model of being the statesman in his first term and dealt with the recalcitrant Republican Party. I also think, just to comment on what the other guests talked about in terms of the gun issue, he did mention Newtown today, but he did it in a very artful way, in the same way that he did in the aftermath of the shooting of Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, in talking about the quiet lanes of Newtown and always keeping our children safe from harm. And so again, I think what the president does very well is to privilege values, so the safety of children over in favor of enlightened gun legislation. To the other point, at least in terms of how the Republicans have responded to him, I think part of what Obama's done in the speech is to say this second term is going to be about his values, his agenda, standing resolute behind what he believes in and hoping that the other side will come along, but not waiting for them to do so as he did in the previous term.
So, Glenn Thrush, back to you at Politico. He did mention Newtown along with other places where Americans had to be kept safe, although not mentioning gun control by name. Do you think that that is preparation for what he's going to say in the State of the Union?
I do, and I think this is really signature Obama, where you establish a moral and emotional connection with an audience, and then you sort of telescope in for a more specific policy proposal. And it is, in fairness, a little harsh to attack him for not mentioning it with specificity when we spent the whole week talking about 29 different measures. But we are told that yes, this will be a case that he makes directly to Republican senators and representatives when he does the state.
Okay, Glenn Thrush, again, a senior White House reporter for Politico. Many thanks for being on our program. We're going to continue this conversation later on Reporter's Notebook. We'll talk a bit about the First Lady and the Obama family as well. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, continuing our conversation about the president's inaugural speech, the second inaugural speech, of course, of Barack Obama, and the last. Every president is limited to just two terms in office. Mary Kate Carey is a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush and a columnist for U.S. News and World Report. Mary Kate Carey, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What did you think about the speech today? What do you think its impact will be on the country as a whole and on Republicans in particular?
As a speechwriter, nobody wants to write an inaugural address. One of my friends, a Clinton speechwriter, told me there's a lot of competition for worst inaugural address. There's not a lot of competition for best inaugural address. So so in general, I'd like to say it was well written and the speechwriter did a great job. But I have to say, I don't think there are very many memorable sound bites in it, just as there weren't 4 years ago. I don't think most people could quote you back something from 4 years ago. The thing about inaugural addresses, Warren, is people don't speak the way that they give inaugural addresses. It's a different type of speaking style, a different language. The sentence structures are different. There are no statistics. There's very few anecdotes. You can't quote, you know, Yogi Berra or some of the people speechwriters love to quote. So it's a difficult speech to give. But last time, for example, President Obama ended his first inaugural with a very moving story about George Washington in Valley Forge, you know, and him addressing the troops. And then Obama turns to the crowd and says, you know, let us carry forward what George Washington started and bring the great light of freedom to future generations. And it was a real, you know, rah-rah ending. And this time, I don't think we saw that. There was no sort of call to action. If you look at the wind-up towards the end of the speech, he talks about you and I as citizens have an opportunity to shape the debate and take our oath as citizens. And it starts really getting there. And then all of a sudden, you get to this sort of clunker last sentence where he calls on people to embrace our lasting birthright and answer the call of history. And you think, well, what does that mean? So I don't feel like he really rallied the troops either on the left of his own supporters, nor did he really offer a real olive branch to Republicans to cross the aisle and join him moving the country forward. I mean, at the sort of 30,000-foot level, he did by tying the founding fathers' values to what's important to him. And if you could get Republicans to agree to the same values, then you could move forward. But to me, I didn't hear the call to action that I was looking for.
Mary Kate Carey, again, a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Samuel Popkin is political science professor at the University of California, San Diego. He was a consultant to Bill Clinton and to Al Gore's campaigns. His most recent book is The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Well, it's always nice to be back with you.
You haven't written inaugural speeches, but you've certainly advised presidents and presidential candidates in what they might say. What did you think of today's speech?
I heard a very different speech in some ways than the people I respect so much who have been on, like Glenn Thrush and Taylor Branch, among others. I heard a lot of Adam Smith. I heard a president who actually mentioned collective goods. And while I was thinking about it all before you called me, I realized in many ways he was answering and elaborating and explaining the infamous "you didn't build that" comment. You know, he went out of his way, like Adam Smith, to talk about initiative, and he made the point that these programs don't sap initiative, they free us to take risks. And he, over and over, he talked about the government's role in the infrastructure, the collective action is what he mentioned, and he's referring to the collective goods that you didn't build on your own, the research, the highways. And I thought of it very much as offering a logic and a rationale that old-fashioned, more moderate Republicans could agree on. So he was, in effect, laying down talking points of why people could go along with this in Congress.
Here's an example of one of the ways in which he spoke about government and what it can do for people in a very positive way.
The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative, they strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great.
Mary Kate Carey, back to you, a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, referring directly to some of the things that Mitt Romney said during the campaign about a nation of takers. Your response.
Well, I would agree with the professor that old-fashioned, reasonable Republicans found a lot to go for in this speech, in the sense that, you know, what you were just talking about, the quote from Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security being part of the social fabric of our society. I think if Republicans were wise going into the next spending battle, they would make that argument in terms of that's why it needs to be saved. That's why we need to get it back to solvency. Similarly, you know, your earlier discussion with Taylor Branch and the professors was about couching the gay rights argument in terms of the equality of every American is the way to go to social conservatives to try to get their support for gay rights. That's the argument to make. And so, as I was saying, at sort of 30,000-foot level, he did make the case for his liberal agenda in terms of the Founding Fathers and the Constitution in words that work with people on the right. What I wanted to see, you know, my old boss, by the way, I don't mean to correct you, but I was a speechwriter for President Bush 41, H.W. Bush.
I beg your pardon. Okay.
No problem.
Thank you for the correction. No, I want to put you in the right historical context.
Okay. So his inaugural in 89, it was a similarly, you know, divided atmosphere. In fact, both houses were Democrat in 89. He turned on the podium to the House and Senate leadership and said, to my loyal friends, and I do mean friends and I do mean loyal, in the loyal opposition, I offer you my hand. A new breeze is blowing. The American people did not send us here to bicker. The time for action is now. And he went on to quote St. Augustine, saying all things, excuse me, let me get it right, in crucial things, unity, in important things, diversity, in all things, generosity. And then he turned to them and said, and this, my friends, is crucial. And so I would have loved to have heard something like that from Barack Obama directly to the Republican leadership, couching it in these values like we're talking about, saying, if you agree with me, let's move forward. And he never got there. He kept it a little too above the fray. I would have liked to see a real acknowledgement of the divide in Washington right now and how he's trying to fix it. Because otherwise, I'm left with the feeling that he's not particularly interested in fixing it. And I find that disappointing
as
an old-fashioned Republican. Yeah.
Mitch McConnell, the current minority leader of the Democrat-dominated Senate, put out a statement today talking about a new start. What do you think he's talking about?
I'd like to think the same thing we're saying, you know, that a new breeze is blowing and kind of hit the reset button. And, you know, the stories I read over the weekend in Glenn Thrush's publication about what was going on down in Williamsburg with the House Republicans, how they are backing off a little bit from the government shutdown talk, I think is very smart. And I sense that's what Mitch McConnell's hinting at is sort of a ebbing of the brinksmanship, which I think is probably a good thing for the Republican brand.
So back to Samuel Popkin again, who's assisted to Bill Clinton and Al Gore. I hope I got your associations correct. I put Mary-Kate Carey with the wrong Bush. But are you surprised that there was nothing at all in this speech, really, about foreign affairs?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's not much to say when you really want to get out of the wars and deal with all these new problems. Algeria is too soon to deal with, and we're down. Nobody in the country is very interested in foreign affairs right now. This is no time for ask not what you can do for your country. I thought his entire emphasis was on saying that what's good for minorities is good for everybody because it's about making everybody take part and have initiative. I heard that as a strong theme. And the difference with Bush 41, Bush 41 could agree with most of the speech, but the 88 campaign was divisive in an unusual way, and a man of high character, rightly or wrongly, was considered to have poisoned the atmosphere by a lot of old-fashioned moderates, rightly or wrongly, and I think his speech dealt with that. I think this campaign was a very different kind of campaign in the middle, and if the president had a political goal, it was to separate the moderate Republicans from the Tea Party.
Cheryl Conte is founder of Jack and Jill Politics. That's a website that proves a middle-class African-American perspective, provides, rather, a middle-class African-American perspective on U.S. politics. Cheryl Conte, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks, Warren.
We heard on the first part of our program before you joined us a good deal about the president's outreach today to lesbian, gay, and transsexual Americans, and he was very explicit about that, mentioning Stonewall, first time any president has done that, connecting it with famous events in the women's rights movement and the civil rights movement as well. Very interested in your take on that and where you think or how you think middle-class African-Americans are going to respond to it.
Well, I mean, there were lots of African-Americans in the crowd you could see on TV in person, and those were lines that got among the biggest applause. You know, when the president started off with saying, you know, our journey is not complete until, you know, essentially women can earn, you know, an equal living, you know, and then he followed with, you know, our gay brothers and sisters. That also received an equal, almost equal amount of applause. So, you know, I think when you look at the statistics in the nation, you know, the tide has turned, and a majority of Americans actually support gay marriage. You can see it in the states that were that embraced gay marriage in this last election. So, you know, I think the president did an interesting and historic job in actually moving the country forward. Showing more leadership there.
Do you think that it will, as one of our earlier guests said, invigorate the base?
The entire base or the black base?
Choose. Let's start with the black base.
Yeah, I don't know that it will necessarily, you know, I think the emphasis on gay rights will not necessarily invigorate the black base. I think there's a lot, though, for that African-Americans that will resonate with them and with Latinos and with Asian Americans. I do think that in general, though, gay rights has been a calling card for the progressive movement, and it's been part of the coalition that has helped propel Barack Obama to office. So, yeah, I think this is really important for maintaining the strength of that coalition of, you know, poor whites, minorities, women, and the LGBT community.
Here's a bit of what the president had to say with regard to immigrants.
Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity. Until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country.
Mary Kate Carey, back to you, formerly with Republican President George H.W. Bush. What about the immigration issue and the way the president referred to it today? Is that going to help him get what's referred to as comprehensive immigration reform?
Yeah, I think he started laying the groundwork for it, and certainly in terms that most people could agree with. I think it's the second half of that sentence where he said bright students and engineers are in our workforce rather than expelled from our country, that is actually something Mitt Romney called for in his campaign. So Tom Friedman says, you know, we should staple a green card to every PhD, you know, diploma. That's the kind of stuff he's talking about. And Republicans agree with that. So that was a smart thing to put in there, because that is certainly not the most hot button issue on immigration reform. So he was smart to start with something that both sides can agree on. I think he was laying the groundwork for that.
And here's an issue that many environmentalists have criticized the president for not talking about enough, not doing anything about.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms.
Samuel Popkin, our Democrat, political science professor at the University of California in San Diego. Do you think this suggests that the president will make a real legislative effort to do something about climate change?
what he does will be something very different from what anybody thought was appropriate in 2008. You know, nobody in 2008 ever thought that natural gas was going to swamp a lot of solar, for example. He'll do something, but it's not clear at all whether it will be about living with the change or trying to deal with it on a global basis, which so many countries are giving up on. But he will have to, in one way or the other, deal with the enormous increase in storms, damage, and danger. And I think it's going to be hard until the economy really picks up for him to do as much as he might like.
And here is another thematic statement by the president. I think Cheryl Conte will respond to this one. Let's run that.
For we, the people, understand that our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well and a growing many barely make it. We believe that America's prosperity must rest upon the broad shoulders of a rising middle class.
And back to Cheryl Conte of Jack and Jill Politics, a website focusing on middle-class African-American perspectives. Is that something that the constituency you talked to really wanted to hear?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that was a nod to the 99% versus the 1%, and Barack Obama clearly laying out, you know, which side he's on there. You know, but touching back on global warming, that also was a big applause line. And, you know, when you look at, again, polls, a majority of Americans are concerned about global warming. I don't think there's much the president can do legislatively, but I think he can lead the cultural change that's going to allow us to at least adapt to climate change, if not actually address it.
All right. Cheryl Conte is going to stay with us as we go to our reporter's notebook and talk a bit about the First Lady and the Obama family. I want to thank Mary Carey, a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, Samuel Popkin, advisor to Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and our other guests, Yehura Williams at Fairfield University and Taylor Branch, of course, the prize-winning historian. His latest book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. We'll be right back with reporter's notebook on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warman, I'll be back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Cheryl Conte is still with us, once again, founder of Jack and Jill Politics, website providing a middle-class African-American perspective on U.S. politics. Michelle Obama, one of the most popular figures in the United States, but also a controversial figure amongst some feminists. How do you think, is she going to, do you think, change her profile at all in the second term?
Well, Michelle Obama is more popular than the president, you know, according to, you know, whenever you see polls on the matter. So, you know, I think she's going to stay the course. Her emphasis has been on military families, and I think we're going to continue, and on health care, obesity. As Obamacare now comes into full flower, I think we may see her take a role there as well, which will be interesting.
She's also been very involved in diet, as you said, obesity, and gardening.
Yeah, so I think, you know, with especially the president actually starting to take on the global warming effort, I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see if gardening, you know, organic, you know, urban farming, you know, becomes also part of what the First Lady begins to talk about, you know, in context of health and obesity.
Let me introduce Caritha Mitchell. She is professor of English at Ohio State University, literary historian, cultural critic, author of Living with Lynching. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What about the feminist critique of Mrs. Obama for giving up her professional career, devoting herself to the concept of motherhood, of course, very importantly, but also some of the other sort of more homely issues that we just heard described?
Well, I think it's really clear to me, at least, that some of the criticism has to do with this idea that somehow she's not working, and that would be a really narrow conception of work. The fact that we've gotten to the point where we can acknowledge that homemaking is a kind of work should be reflected in those comments. And the fact that it's not is interesting to me, but it seems to me even more important that we acknowledge things like Let's Move. And as Ms. Conti was mentioning, part of what's important about the Let's Move movement is that she actually is addressing food deserts in the midst of this. So it hasn't probably been at the forefront as much as it will be in the future, but she's addressing food deserts through this Let's Move campaign, partnerships with Olive Garden, partnerships with the Department of Defense, and so on. So all of that is clearly work, clearly labor. So it seems a really strange critique, to say the least.
And Cheryl Conti, is this emphasis on homemaking as work and on diet and nutrition and the food deserts in the inner cities, is this something that you think makes her one of the most popular people, more popular even than the president?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, while there are feminists who may critique the First Lady, I think, you know, women across the nation, you know, actually see her as a model. I mean, there's no question when you look at, you know, what Michelle Obama is doing day to day that she's working, right? Being in the First Lady is a job unto itself. And so, you know, I do think it's an unpaid job, unfortunately. I think that it should be paid. And that's where, you know, the real sexism comes in.
That's an interesting idea. Professor Mitchell, what about the idea of paying the First Lady, acknowledging that she has a job as well as the president and that she ought to be directly compensated for it?
That actually is brilliant. And if we made moves like that, we would be a much more progressive nation, right? We would be on the way to actually paying people for the work that they do in their homes instead of structuring it as if it's just about love, also acknowledging that it's labor. But one of the things I would love to underscore here, though, is that we have to acknowledge, you know, there's been a lot of talk in response to these critiques from feminists saying that she's not working, and some of the responses have been, well, this is about choice. Isn't feminism about choice? And I just want to underscore that it seems to me that that's a really kind of naive response, because the truth is we live in a nation that still sees women in a very particular way. Now, Michelle Obama was a hospital administrator for a very long time. Surely her interest in public health is influenced by that. However, because we're still very much a sexist patriarchal society, she has to package it as mom in chief. And so I think that our conversation about that has to acknowledge the degree to which she's being more palatable by making it, by putting it in terms of motherhood, when in fact her professional background has positioned her perfectly for exactly the kind of work that she's doing. So we need to get real about how much she's responding to the very real circumstances of our sexist society.
And Cheryl Conti, representing middle-class African Americans, she's not just a former hospital administrator. She was a graduate of Princeton and a graduate of the Harvard Law School. Could it be said that she's wasting that very high-level education, or is she finding the best possible way of implementing it?
Well, I think becoming First Lady is a pretty good job and a pretty good justification for her work. Look, you know, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama have in some ways switched places. For a long time, she actually made more money than he did and was the breadwinner in their family, and now things have shifted. Of course, you know, we see the public shift and not, you know, the hard work as a team that they put in together. So, you know, I can anyone really imagine her continuing to do, run a hospital in Washington, D.C. and still go on, you know, run state dinners and, you know, travel with the president? I mean, being a First Lady is a job. And it's time that we acknowledge that.
Caritha Mitchell, you mentioned the anti-feminist society that we have, the sexist society, as you described it. What about all the attention that's paid to her hair, her bangs, the clothes that she wears? And, of course, that extends to her children as well.
Thank you. Well, It seems to me that this would be another way for us to be more dynamic in the way that we understand labor. I would argue that the way that she is handling herself in terms of hair, clothes, and the presentation of her body is very much labor. And what I mean by that is she's been very, if I take clothes as an example, she's been very deliberate about making sure that we see her as a J. Crew mom, making sure that we see her as someone who's accessible, who doesn't use a stylist, who often wears dresses that are in a price range that middle-class women can imagine, right? So she goes on The View. She wears a dress from White House Black Market. This is within reach. She wears clothes from Talbots. So all of that represents really deliberate choices on her part to underscore a Democratic strategy of really taking the middle class into account and allowing you to see yourself in the clothes that she wears, to the point where when she went on The View with that black and white dress, it sold out in a matter of hours.
Okay, thank you both. We are out of time. Today's program produced by Anna Scott, Evan George, and Katie Cooper. Special thanks to Chase Stone. Our technical director is Phil Richards. I'm Warren Olney. Here is the Star Spangled Banner as rendered by Beyoncé.
Public Radio International.